court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Two Dudes Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
It's episode two coming to you live from high atop Huntington upon...
Three last mountain. You forgot, didn't you?
I did.
You're just going to say Smurl Basement.
Smurl Basement. Coming to you high above Huntington from Smurl Basement.
That's right. We are high looking down, aren't we?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. I like it up here. The view is beautiful. I posted a picture of the sunrise the other morning there on my Facebook page.
Yeah, you did. It's funny. When I was doing that, I kind of felt like I was a radio DJ doing an intro.
With stacks and stacks of really hot wax.
Coming to you with 50,000 watts of power.
I am the morning DJ at WOLDDDDD.
Is that from a show?
You don't remember that one?
Was that WKRT?
No.
Something?
No, that was an old Harry Chapin song.
Oh, okay. Well, we're not actually talking about radio stations on this episode, but we are talking about Wall Street and Finance and the SEC.
The SEC? The Southeastern Conference? You mean just because they had two teams in the national championship? Why would we talk about them? I hate Alabama. Boo!
I knew the SEC was going to bring up a football reference. But
I'm an Auburn fan. I can't ever root for Alabama. It'd be like rooting for WVU. Boo.
Well, I'm actually a Gator fan because I lived in Gainesville for a while, and you can't live in Gainesville and not be a Gator fan. It's just not possible.
Well, that's true. They have a fun team to watch most of the time.
Yeah,
they've had some rough times here lately.
This year was not so fun. When I was there, Tim Tebow was at the helm, and he was pretty fun to watch. So say what you want about that guy. He was college football.
It's always funny to me, the guys that are good college quarterbacks and just don't transition to the NFL. It's like it's a completely different game.
It is, but I'll tell you what. Tebow, in the playoffs, I mean, I came up on my timeline not too long ago, like when he beat the Steelers on that comeback.
Oh, yeah, that pass for that touchdown?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then did he play another down in the NFL after that?
Yeah, but the only problem was is... Yeah, he played some after that, but the only problem was is you'd get to the end of the game and he was like 8 for 23 or something like that. His passing was not not on par.
The guy just found a way to win, though.
He did. He found a way to win. You're right about that.
So
whatever it took.
But we could probably sit here and talk about football because Tommy and I both are big football fans.
But that's not what we're here for, are we, dude?
We're here to talk about the Securities and Exchange Commission and Wall Street and that kind of SEC.
You're picking up on that after I railed about the Intel CEO that sold off all his stock and we talked about insider trading.
That's right.
And so, but a lot of people might have a question, what exactly is insider trading? Who governs it? And what are the laws? And where did they come from?
Exactly.
And that's what we're here to answer, aren't we?
We are. Now, in my practice as a lawyer, I'm more of kind of a courtroom type lawyer, so I don't really know too much about Securities and Exchange Commission and things like this, and that's not really my bailiwick.
Need to go find somebody else to help me with this episode or something?
Well, that's kind of a mean thing to say.
I expect you to know everything about everything. You are the law.
I have a black belt in
Google. You're just like Sylvester Stallone. I am the law.
I have a black belt in Google Foo.
So oh, okay.
I'm up to par on this one. So,
well, you got your Black's Dictionary you carry around, so you can learn all that stuff.
That's right. I'm going to look it up in my Funkin' Wagnalls.
I thought you said it was a Black's Dictionary you have to carry around.
Well, that was my reference, to look it up in your Funkin' Wagnalls. Isn't that like an old TV reference?
That's old from the old Rowan and Martin Laugh-In.
There you go.
Yeah.
Look at me pulling these.
Look that up in your Funkin' Wagnalls.
Well, the one thing you were talking about was insider trading. So
correct. And yeah, that it was very bad.
It is very bad. I think you had gone into a little bit of the history of the SEC and where it came from.
I have the
beginning of it. Now, I just want to go ahead and let everybody know that since we are new here at Smurl Studios, we have been doing a little bit of work at the studio. And since Tommy loves to rail about Wall Street and banks and all that, we've gone ahead and bolted down the soapbox here because it's going to be used probably quite frequently during this episode.
So it's a permanent fixture.
It's a permanent fixture here at Smurl Studios.
We don't have to worry about Justin or his brothers tripping over it when they're in recording because now we're in my basement, not his.
That's right.
Well, the Securities and Exchange Commission is an independent agency of the United States federal government. It was created in the Securities Act of 1933. Guess what big event happened right before 1933 that created the need for this?
That would be the stock market crash in 1929.
Yes, the Great Depression that was caused as a result of it. A lot of it had to do with insider trading and no real rules regarding the stock market. People were playing fast and loose with it, and there was a lot of stuff going on. It's kind of like having money that's not backed up by anything.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the way the stocks were. There was a lot of people buying stocks, but they weren't putting the money in there. They were trading stocks for stocks, and the actual cash wasn't there. And it was kind of like a big Ponzi game. And eventually it caught up, and that's where everything crashed.
The bubble kept getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
Sounds very familiar to the real estate market, too, with a crash and the mortgage boom.
Yeah, kind of the same thing. Well, and we have new regulations concerning that, too, because of it.
We don't actually have hard currency that changes hands. It's more kind of a theoretical type thing. Things get a little out of whack.
Well, and the thing that happened with the housing market was, too, is because they were trying to level the playing field, they made it so that people were qualifying for loans that they were getting and they didn't have the means to pay the money back.
Yeah, and that's a problem.
So it actually set them up for failure.
Yeah.
So there's a certain amount of it that's good. It makes opportunities for people, but you can go too far with it and you're putting people in over their head, and maybe they're okay for the first 3 years and that bubble goes away, that bubble payment or whatever. Now what do I do?
Yeah.
And that's what that housing one did.
Well, I didn't mean to get you off track, but...
Well, that's all right.
I just thought it was kind of interesting.
You know, we cover a little bit of everything here on Quarter Pointed. We don't want to leave any stone unturned. But the SEC has a three-part mission: to protect investors, maintain fair, orderly, and efficient markets, and facilitate capital formation. Now, the thing about the SEC is when they got it started, they thought, you know what? We need somebody to run this who really knows how things work and what the pitfalls are to avoid. Mm-hmm. So when you're looking for somebody like that, the person that you find is someone who maybe knows all those things because maybe they did all those things and got away with it and they still came out on top. So the first commissioner of the SEC was Joseph P. Kennedy Sr., John F. Kennedy's father.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And see, he made a lot of his money off of the stock market crash, as well as the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and several others that were able to buy up all these stocks that had bottomed out for pennies. And so later on, they were able to turn them around, use all this, buy up all these stocks and make money off of it.
Now, didn't the Kennedys make a lot of money during Prohibition from bootlegging?
I think they were bootleggers, too.
Yeah.
Just depends on which book you read. One of those unauthorized novels or whatever it is.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty interesting. If they took their bootlegging money, they did some insider trading, and then rose to the top.
But so what they did is they had to get together, and they had to form all the laws that they thought would keep people from ever happening, the Great Depression, the stock market crash, from happening again. So one of the things that set up was insider trading, that basically says if you are the CEO of a company or someone in a position of knowledge with a company, if you are a stock trader that is privileged to get certain kind of information, you cannot act on that knowledge that the ordinary man on the street, you know, your Tom Smurl walking down the street, wouldn't know about this.
You're no ordinary man, Tom.
I consider myself an ordinary man. As a matter of fact, I'm subordinate in most cases. But anyway, you can't act on that kind of information. It made it against the law.
Yeah, so basically, if there's any kind of trading conducted by corporate officers, key employees, directors, or anybody who has like a significant share or stakeholder in a company, they have to report to the regulator of the SEC or publicly disclose within a few business days of the trade. And We talked about this a little bit in the episode last week, and I wasn't really sure what it was, but they're required to file what's called a Form 4 with the SEC when they're buying or selling shares of their own company. And that's one of the requirements for those people. If they're doing it, they have to disclose this. And I think that was the Intel guy filed his Form 4 and said that, you know, he didn't know anything about it. So that was one of the things we talked about last week.
Right, but it had been proven that they had knowledge of this problem well before he filed that paperwork.
Exactly. So I think we're going to talk about more about some actual cases of it here in a little bit.
Oh, but yes.
In the U.S., basically, sections 16B and 10B of the SEC Act of 1934 directly and indirectly address insider trading. And as Tommy had said, this was in direct result of the stock market crash of 1929. They wanted to try to keep that from happening again. So those are the actual sections of the code which prohibit that.
Stock market crashes are bad for your country. You want to avoid them if possible.
They are. Take it from Tom.
Stock market crash? Bad. Stock market doing well? Good. Those are some basic rules.
Let's boil it down for an ordinary man. It's called take it from Tom. Stock market crash? Bad.
I like that. Those are pearls of wisdom.
Yeah, I like that. I like that new segment. Take it from Tom.
That's your stock tip from Tom. I don't deal in stocks much. The only stock I ever owned is when I got some stock options when I worked for a company that gave bonuses for a while. Mm-hmm. And I had those options and exercised those and ended up with some stock. And as soon as it matured and I could sell it, I sold it and took the cash. So whenever I have people calling me up, they think because I own my own company, I got mountains of cash laying around, I guess. I say, look, I run a small business. If I had extra money, you know, I would not spend it on stock. I would use it to buy something, fix up my house, whatever, you know, but you're not going to get it. So you're wasting your time. Don't call me.
You're barking up the wrong tree.
Yeah.
Go talk to Mike. He's a liar. He's got a money tree.
That's right. I don't have a money tree because you're wasting your time, dude. It's not that I don't trust you, even though I don't trust you. It's just, I don't have the money. Go call somebody else.
Now there's some people, that say that insider trading is actually a good thing there, right?
Yeah, I don't really follow their logic, but there are people that say that.
Okay, because I mean, I know there's one theory that says that if you have insider trading, that basically it's going to raise the cost of capital and decrease economic growth generally. But then there's some other that say that maybe it actually benefits.
Well, there's some economists and legal scholars that they've argued that laws against insider trading should be replaced. They claim that insider trading based on material, non-public information benefits investors in general by more quickly introducing new information into the market. He said you want more insider trading, not less. You want to give the people most likely to have knowledge about deficiencies of the company an incentive to make the public aware of that.
Yeah.
So
I kind of see the train of thought with it, but I think it's kind of faulty logic because I think it's... I don't think that's going to trickle down to help people. I think it's only going to help the people who are actually...
Yeah, the ones in front of it are the ones that are going to benefit because, I mean, here again, we get back to Tom's stock tips. Here's the basic way it works is you want to buy low and sell high.
Take it from Tom. Here you have it.
That's what you want to do if you want to be successful. Now, how do you buy low? You buy things that are just starting out or, you know, aren't worth a whole lot. And then you want something to happen that makes that stock more desirable, and you got a lot of people wanting to buy it. Because when a lot of people are wanting to buy it, the price goes up. The more they buy, the more it goes up. So if you had a way to manipulate those things and make your stock look more desirable or make people buy it, if you had a blind trust that you could use and it looked like your stock was selling real big, then other people might say, hey, look at this. This stock is going up. Those people know something. Quick, buy it.
Yeah.
And you generate that. Then all these people buy it. The stock goes up. Then you sell off all those shares you just bought. And you just doubled your money or whatever. You know, so there's ways to manipulate the market. And that's why I don't think that's right. Because it gives these people more freedom to manipulate the market. And you want the market to be fair and equal for everybody.
There's been a lot of movies that have kind of talked about insider trading and some of the stuff we're talking about. One of the more recent ones was Wolf of Wall Street with mm-hmm. Leonardo DiCaprio. Really good movie. It's pretty funny, too.
Right.
There's a movie called Boiler Room which talked about them selling stocks, I believe.
I've heard of that. I never saw it.
It was pretty good. But the first movie that ever introduced me to any kind of these stock market things or issues with insider trading was actually a classic, a comedy classic, Trading Places.
Oh, Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd and Jamie Lee Curtis.
That's right. And it it actually had one of the more intricate plots of, as far as this insider trading, too.
You know, so, I'd forgotten about the insider trading aspect of that movie. I just remembered that they traded around the lives of Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
To see if it's kind of like a My Fair Lady type thing.
Yeah.
To see if they could make Eddie Murphy successful and crush Dan Aykroyd if they put him in each other's situation.
Yeah, and so the whole, I mean, that's the basic plot of it, but the other kind of subplot, which I guess is was the resolution of the whole part of the film, is that they were these kind of like the Duke brothers, a good nice fitting name. They're these old, rich, white guys, and what they had done is, and this is later on in the movie, they had bribed somebody to get an advanced copy of the government report on the orange crop.
Oh, yeah.
And so remember, it was all about the orange juice report. And so what this was basically going to give them inside information about what was going to happen in the market for frozen concentrated orange juice. So it's very, you know, very strange if you think about it, that this is what the whole movie is about, but people actually, you know, trade on this. And so
pork bellies. That's one of the few things that I know, concentrated orange juice and pork bellies.
And so basically Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy, their characters were able to steal the crop report before the brothers could get this and then changed it around. So what happened is, and this is where it gets kind of tricky. The report said that the orange crop is strong. And so basically when the rest of the world would learn this, the price of orange juice would fall. So what Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd did, they created a fake crop report to say that the crop was bad. And they made sure that this was the report that the Duke brothers got into their hands. And so basically they go into the next scene is that they go into, and there was this whole thing on the train where the Jamie Lee Curtis was distracting the guy and all that. And she was pretty distracting.
Well, that was when she was called the body in Hollywood.
And so basically they go to the floor and the market opens and the Duke brothers, they start buying. And basically everybody sees this and thinks that the Dukes know that something is up. So suddenly everybody starts buying all these orange juice futures. And they're trading futures here, which is a little bit different than stocks. And we'll get into that here in a minute. So basically the price goes up and up and up and everybody keeps buying. And so then everything goes quiet, and basically they look at the TV, and then the secretary sees the crop report, and basically the guy tells the world the crop report's fine. So it kind of flips the switch on, like, oh, why were they buying all this? And that means that the price of orange juice is not really going to go through the roof, but actually they were kind of creating artificial. And so basically it ends up that the Duke brothers were duped, and the orange market futures were essentially in the favor of Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy, and they end up being rich. And the two old rich white guys end up being poor on the street. So that's Trading Places in a nutshell.
So what they ended up trading places with Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy. Because they ended up on top and the Duke brothers ended up on the bottom on the street.
And therein lies the irony. But yeah, it's a great movie. I haven't seen it actually in quite some time, but as a child, I remember watching it and it left quite an impression on me.
I always remember the scene at the beginning where Eddie Murphy is posing as a blind, legless man. He's on
the roller
thing,
yeah,
going along and begging money, and the cops lift him up under each shoulder. There's his legs.
Yeah.
He was hilarious in that movie, though.
But in this movie, they were actually, and I didn't realize this, but they were trading what's called futures. And right. Futures are different than stocks. And the futures are controlled by the CFTC.
The CFTC, there's always these acronyms for everything the government does.
There are. And it stands for Commodity Futures Trading Commission. So that's different than the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
Different conference altogether.
Yeah. Yeah. Alabama's not in that conference.
They're not in that one. And so one of the interesting things is that the CFTC in 2010 actually passed a new rule, and they called it the Eddie Murphy rule after Trading Places.
Wow.
And because it turns out that basically what they did in that movie by stealing the government report or getting this privy information from the government ahead of time and using it to their benefit, technically wasn't actually illegal until 2010 under the CFTC.
Really? You could put out a false report?
Well, but the whole thing is basically the whole, if you could, you could benefit from using a government report which was leaked early. So what they were trying to say is that you shouldn't be able to do that.
Right.
So, but the actual
test, because that would tempt people to bribe public officials that had access to this report.
Yeah. But you may think about this. This plot of this movie, Trading Places, came out, what, like 83, 84?
Something like that, yeah.
It's an older movie.
It's been a while.
2010's when Washington finally caught up and said, hey, you remember what they did in Trading Places? Maybe we need to pass a rule against that.
Yeah, they don't act too quickly there.
So basically, this is the actual testimony. In 2010, March 2010, we have recommended banning using misappropriated government information to trade in the commodity markets. In the movie Trading Places starring Eddie Murphy, the Duke brothers intended to profit from trades in frozen concentrated orange juice futures contracts using illicitly obtained and not yet public Department of Agriculture orange crop report. Characters played by Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd intercept the misappropriated report and trade on it to profit and ruin the Duke brothers. In real life, using such misappropriated government information actually is not illegal under our statute. To protect our markets, we have recommended what we call the Eddie Murphy rule to ban insider trading using non-public information misappropriated from a government source.
You know what's really sad about that? The government gets their legal information from the same place I do. TVs and movies.
Yeah.
You'd think they'd have high-priced lawyers that could advise them better than they have to watch a movie and say, hey, you know what? Maybe we should cover that up. Maybe that's a real problem.
I don't know.
That's unbelievable. But, you know, it falls right in line with what I read. You know, as I said, when they first started the SEC, they needed people that were familiar with the ins and outs mm-hmm. of all that to set it. Well, that continues to this day. The people on the commission are actually people from the stock market community that have some connection to it. Therein lies the problem, because a lot of them have friends and associates and business connections and a lot of other things. In other words, there's a lot of money at stake on the decisions they make.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of people influencing those decisions with a lot of money.
Like Steve Spurrier.
Exactly. So the SEC has been criticized for being too tentative and fearful in confronting wrongdoing on Wall Street. And they've done an especially poor job of holding executives accountable, i.e. the Intel CEO. Christopher Cox, the former SEC chairman, has recognized the organization's multiple failures in relation to the Bernie Madoff fraud. Remember that one?
Oh, yeah.
Starting with an investigation in 1992 into a Madoff feeder fund. In other words, they were investigating this long before it ever came to fruition, that only invested with Madoff, and which, according to the SEC, promised curiously steady returns. The SEC did not investigate indications that something was amiss in Madoff's investment firm. The SEC has been accused of missing numerous red flags and ignoring tips on Madoff's alleged fraud. As a result, Cox said that an investigation would ensue into all staff contact and relationships with the Madoff family and firm and their impact, if any, on decisions by staff regarding the firm. Well, you know, here again, it was one of those things. He was well known in that community, and he had all these kind of answers. And even though all these red flags went up, they didn't do anything.
Yeah.
Approximately 45% of institutional investors thought that better oversight by the SEC could have prevented the Madoff fraud. Let's see, a similar failure occurred in the case of Alan Stanford, who sold fake certificates of deposit to tens of thousands of people, many of them working-class retirees in 1997. The SEC's own examiner spotted the fraud and warned about it, but the enforcement division would not pursue Stanford despite repeated warnings by SEC examiners over the years. After the Madoff fraud emerged, the SEC finally took action against Stanford in 2009.
Yeah. Now that's just, those are just examples of outright, like, fraud. That's not really insider trading. That was just like, they're basically.
Right. But what I'm saying, these are things that fell under the SEC's purview.
Right.
And they were slow to do anything about. And a lot of it has to do with, I mean, nepotism isn't the right word, but these people are all interacting with each other and they come from that line of work. These people aren't like law enforcement people or independent counsel.
Yeah.
You know, they're people that came from that community and have connections to that community. They're very slow to prosecute the other ones.
I believe the proper terminology you're looking for is incestuous.
That's probably a very good term, incestuous. So, let's see. On September 26th, Democratic Senator Mark Warner in a letter asked the SEC to evaluate whether the current disclosure regimen was adequate, citing the low number of company disclosures to date. And others have criticized the SEC for taking an overly rule-based and enforcement-focused approach to regulation rather than an approach that emphasizes industry-wide safety and learning. So, I mean, it's recognized that there's a problem here, but really nobody's doing anything about it. Here's what I found was really the most egregious to me. According to former SEC employee and whistleblower Darcy Flynn, she also reported by Tybee, I don't know, the agency routinely destroyed thousands of documents related to preliminary investigations of alleged crimes committed by Deutsche Bank, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, SAC Capital, and other financial companies involved in the Great Recession. In other words, they didn't want it to come out that they had found stuff going on with these companies that helped lead to our recent recession. They found things and they didn't do anything about it, but they didn't want anyone to find out. So they destroyed all these documents. That's what this person came forward and said. The SEC did that so that they couldn't be tied to it.
That's horrible. That flies in the face of the freedom of information.
Exactly. And I mean, that. Why does an investigative record, what does an investigative record mean to Congress and the courts? Under the law, these investigative records must be kept for 25 years, but obviously they didn't. They destroyed them because they didn't want anybody else to see what their failures were or who in the SEC had information and didn't act on it because maybe they were getting bribes or maybe they were benefiting from it or something like that. So we really need to get the foxes out of the hen house.
It's a very appropriate American colloquialism.
Well, that's the way we say it in this neck of the woods.
Is it?
Well, we could.
I don't know. I don't have a hen house.
All right. You don't have a hen house?
And I've only seen a fox twice. You had a fox running around your backyard there not too long ago.
I sure did. Yeah. And then we had a coyote following the fox.
Did you really?
It's like the old lady that swallowed the fly. Yeah.
Yeah, coyotes up here?
Yeah, apparently so. I didn't know that.
You know, they have them in actually urban areas, too. There's a whole documentary about urban coyotes in Chicago.
That coyote ugly?
Actually, I saw one. I was driving along Lakeshore Drive and looked over. I was like, saw it in a park. I was like, oh, there's a coyote running free.
Well, I didn't know what it was. I thought it might be a dog, but it looked a little bit not like a dog.
Yeah, that's pretty much how you describe a coyote.
And then I heard somebody talking about it, and it was a coyote.
Yeah.
So I didn't know myself. I'm not whatever you call a person that looks at animals and knows what they are, an animalologist or something.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Okay. I'm not an animalologist.
So now, do you have some examples of people who have been prosecuted for insider trading?
Well, I have the four most scandalous insider trading debacles.
Well, I'm excited to hear that. I bet I know who a couple of them are.
I bet you do. Well, the very first one, which has to do with the original market crash, stock market crash, was Albert H. Wiggin. During the Roaring Twenties, many Wall Street professionals and even some of the general public knew Wall Street was a rigged game run by powerful investing pools. Suffering from a lack of disclosure and an epidemic of manipulative rumors, people believed coattail investing and momentum investing were the only viable strategies for getting in on the profits. Unfortunately, many investors found that the coattails they were riding were actually smoke screens for hidden sell orders that left them holding the bag. Kind of like trading places.
Yeah.
Still, while the market kept going up and up, these setbacks were seen as a small price to pay in order to get in the big game later on. So in October 1929, the big game was revealed to be yet another smoke screen. So after the crash, the public was hurt, angry, and hungry for vengeance. Albert H. Wiggin, the respected head of the Chase National Bank, seemed an unlikely target until it was revealed that he shorted 40,000 shares of his own company. This is like a boxer betting on his opponent, a serious conflict of interest.
Yeah.
Using wholly owned family corporations to hide the trades, Wiggin built up a position that gave him a vested interest in running his company into the ground. There were no specific rules against shorting your own company in 1929, so Wiggin legally made $4 million from the 1929 crash and the shakeout of Chase stock that followed. Not only was this was this legal at the time, but Wiggin had also accepted $100,000 a year pension for life from the bank, which at the time, $100,000 a year in 1929, you know, that's one of those $100 million golden parachutes you see.
Right.
Know? So he sunk the company, got a bunch of money off of it, and got a nice pension plan from him.
It's the American dream.
Yeah, it's been going on since 1929, and we're still here today talking about it.
Is he the same guy that had Wiggins here in Huntington?
No, he did not start the restaurant.
Okay.
He is not known for his barbecue. He later declined the pension when the public outcry grew too loud to ignore. Well, he already had the millions. Why did he need the 100,000, huh? Wiggin was not alone in his immoral conduct, and similar revelations led to a 1934 revision of the 1933 Securities Act that was much sterner toward insider trading. It was appropriately nicknamed the Wiggins Act. So he got an act named after him because of the way he acted.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it needed to be done.
Now, this next one's a little more current.
I was going to say, the Wiggin Act's a little bit before our time.
Yeah, that was a little bit before our time. But now, this one is up into the 80s, so this is more along our line. One of the most famous cases of insider trading made household names of Michael Milken, Dennis Levine, Martin Siegel, and Ivan Boesky. Milken received the most attention because he was the biggest target for the Securities and Exchange Commission, but it was actually Boesky who was a spider in the center of the web.
Yeah, I remember hearing about this when I was younger.
Boesky was an arbitrageur, which I don't really know what that is, in the mid-1980s, with an uncanny ability to pick out potential takeover targets and invest before an offer was made. When the fated offer came, the target's firm stock would shoot up, and Boesky would sell his shares for profit. Sometimes Boesky would buy mere days before an unsolicited bid was made public, a feat of precognition rivaling the mental powers of spoonbender Uri Geller. Like Geller, Boesky's precognition turned out to be a fraud. Rather than keeping a running tabulation of all the publicly traded firms trading at enough of a discount to their true values to attract offers and investing in the most likely of the group, Boesky went straight to the source, the mergers and acquisition arms of the major investment banks. So, see, he was in bed with all the banks.
Yeah.
So the bank people would have him do that, then they'd get a cut of the money. So when Boesky hit home runs on nearly every major deal in the 1980s, including Getty Oil, Nabisco, Gulf Oil, and Chevron, the people at the SEC became suspicious.
Yeah, that's...
He just happened to go in and buy up a bunch of stock that was very cheap, and suddenly a big acquisition comes along and the stock shoots up, you know.
And he did that about six times.
Yeah, and I mean, there's an example of corporate greed. If he'd have done it once, maybe even twice, and walked away with the cash, he'd have been all right.
Yeah.
But he had to keep doing it. Too much is not enough. That's the problem with these guys. They're all the same.
It's a problem with the CEOs that sell off their stock, too. It's like, you know, they know they're already getting their good money from this. So why they want to try to sell off their stock early?
They got Michael Milken. He was the one that they first went after. So he rolled over on Boesky and said that he was the one behind it. So they drew up a list of 98 charges worth 520 years in prison against the junk bond king, which he became known as. So they ended up taking the brunt of the sentencing and fines from that.
The first guy to roll over usually is in a better position.
Yeah, they always want to get the one guy on everybody else. That's what, like, this thing going on with Trump. The first thing they did on the Russian investigation was go after, what's his name?
Flynn.
Go after Flynn. And then they started squeezing each person on the way up, climbing up the ladder.
I see it on a daily basis with less sophisticated criminals. They're not white-collar criminals, but they're blue-collar criminals. But there's usually a race to see who rolls over first and gets the best deal.
Now, this one was a little bit different. Number three was R. Foster Winans. He's called the corruptible columnist. Well, what he did is he wrote a column about stock market and what here's ones to be on the lookout for that may be climbing. So he was kind of giving advice. Well, what he eventually did, though, is some of these companies would approach him and ask him to write either favorable or unfavorable reports about their company to make the stock go up or down. And so they would have put in their position so that their position is to improve whether they want to buy it or sell it. So they worked with him, and then he'd get a cut of their profits that they were getting. So they were, in a way, manipulating the stock market through giving advice. And once again, that was something that technically it's not illegal. He's writing an opinion column.
Right.
You know, you can't hold somebody responsible for their opinion, but the fact that he was working in cahoots with these other companies, it is obviously a fraud.
Well, and ethically, as a journalist, I'm pretty sure that's like journalism 101. This is not right.
Well, you could just put it under the list of fake news.
Oh, it was just a prank.
Yeah. I was just seeing how much I could get away with.
Yeah.
I was seeing how gullible you people were.
I was just doing this just to show you you shouldn't do this.
Now, here's the one that's the most famous of all. I bet you know.
Martha Stewart?
Yep. Martha Stewart, the homemaker hoaxer.
Well, that's a little rough on her, isn't it?
Well, that's what they called her. I'm just reading what they said. I didn't make that up. In December of 2001, the Food and Drug Administration announced that it was rejecting M-Clone's new cancer drug, Erbitux. As the drug represented a major portion of M-Clone's pipeline, the company's stock took a sharp dive. Many pharmaceutical investors were hurt by the drop, but the family and friends of CEO Samuel Wachsel were, oddly enough, not among them. Among those with a preternatural knack for guessing the FDA's decision days before the announcement was homemaking guru Martha Stewart. She sold 4,000 shares. Now, this was really, you think she's probably a millionaire?
Yeah.
This was a pitiful amount for her to put herself out for. She sold 4,000 shares when the stock was still trading in the high $50 and collected nearly $250,000 on the sale. The stock would plummet to just over $10 in the following months. So, I mean, for her, I mean, yeah, $250,000, I'm not saying that's not a lot of money, but you'd think for her, in her position, is that worth going to jail?
I wouldn't think so.
So, I couldn't believe it. I thought millions of dollars, yeah, people do dumb things for millions of dollars. $250,000, I wouldn't even take a chance for that. And I could really use $250,000. That would mean a lot to me.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Stewart claimed to have a pre-existing sell order with her broker, but a story continued to unravel, and public shame eventually forced her to resign as a CEO of her own company. And Wachsel was arrested and sentenced to more than 7 years in prison and fined $4.3 million in 2003. And in 2004, Stewart and her broker were also found guilty of insider trading. Stewart was sentenced to the minimum of 5 months in prison and fined $30,000. And where did she serve her prison term?
In West Virginia.
That's right.
In Alderson, I believe.
Yeah. Welcome to wild, wonderful West Virginia, Martha.
That's right. We're glad to have you.
And she went around and decorated the bathrooms there, I think. I don't know.
See, you can wrap your shiv with this little lace, and it makes it look nice. The one thing I've about these whole insider trading cases is I think they're actually probably pretty hard to prove for the most part. And I think that might be where there's a lot of trouble for the SEC trying to regulate these things, because you have this, you have to show when this person actually had knowledge of something. Unless you can actually directly show that they had this knowledge in their possession beforehand, it's pretty difficult. I mean, a smoking gun would obviously be like an email sent from so-and-so saying, hey, the orange juice market is bad. You know, like that would be something, you know, that you could prove via an email.
Or an email that said, like, I know we are doing this illegally, and I know we have obtained illegal information. I know we have manipulated the market, but let's do it anyway.
Yeah, like that's good evidence if you're the prosecutor. But for the most part,
I didn't type that. My secretary has access to my email.
If I just nudge you and say, hey, Tommy, I know you invested in this company. I think you should get rid of all your stock. Wink, wink, nod, nod. And that's all that ever happens. And I don't tell anybody else. I just tell you. And you don't tell anybody else. I mean, how are they ever going to find out that you actually even knew that? I mean, it's going to be really hard to prove.
Well, I would propose that they use the duck test.
If it looks like a duck and smells like a duck and walks like a duck.
And quacks like a duck.
And quacks like a duck.
It's a duck.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean, these things are obvious. First of all, you got to assume the CEO of a company knows what the hell's going on.
Right.
You know, they know if a drug didn't get approved. They know if a security thing has failed. They know if there's a big pending lawsuit against them. If they do anything unusual with their stock from the time they find that out till the time it becomes public knowledge, that's a duck.
Well, but here's the problem. When you're in front of a jury and you're telling them what the burden of proof is, it's not the duck standard. It's not, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you've heard the evidence. This looks like a duck. It talks like a duck. It walks like a duck. It quacks like a duck.
It's a duck.
It's a duck. No, we work on reasonable doubt.
So. I would think the jury would follow that line of reasoning and say, you're right.
And I would probably bring a duck into the courtroom and show them, like, and here is a duck.
That's right.
That's kind of what might be called circumstantial.
And his lawyer is a quack.
That might be like what you might call circumstantial type evidence. And you need to have actual hard evidence for the most part. I mean, if you have layers upon layers upon layers of circumstantial evidence, that can definitely be a basis beyond reasonable doubt. But for the most part, you know, you want to have something a bit firmer.
Well, I think that what they should enact is if you're at a certain level in a company and, you know, the executives of the company, you know, your CEOs, your presidents, vice presidents, all this chief financial officer certainly knows things that financially affect the company. Those people should be under some kind of an order that if they want to buy or sell stock, they should have to put some kind of written contract out there that has a delay on it. Like when you buy a house, you have 10 days when you sign a contract or something like that, that you can rescind it or
like
something.
Like a closing date out for the future.
Yeah. And that should then be made public. Your intention to buy or sell stock should be made public. So everyone in the trading community that keeps up with that stuff, I mean, to me, it wouldn't matter. I don't care who buys or sells what. I'm not going to buy it or sell it anyway. But there's people whose livelihoods depend on that kind of information. That should then become public so the people that care and are keeping their eye on the ball says, huh, this CEO's dumping all his stock except for the minimum he has to have to be the CEO. I'll bet you there's a duck quacking here. You know? I really think that they should have some kind of laws in place so that everybody knows this ahead of time before they can do it, so they can't get out in front of everybody else.
It's an interesting law. I don't know in practice how that would work, but...
Well, also, you're asking it to be implemented by people that probably benefited from it not existing.
That's probably true as well.
The SEC people who came from that community. And then, you know, it's not just people in the stock market business and CEOs of company that take advantage of some of this stuff. I know this, you'll find this hard to believe, as upstanding and reputable and honest and everything as these people are, we have members of Congress that often benefit from insider information. Can you believe that?
I am shocked and astounded.
I am just shocked and dismayed. I could not believe this. That members of Congress would take advantage of information that they have that the general public doesn't, and they would trade stocks and gain financial gain out of it?
Have you ever seen the movie Casablanca? Or Casablanca?
Well, you mean Humphrey Bogart?
Yeah.
Well, I mean... No, I can't say I've watched it all the way through. Isn't that the one where at the end, what's his famous line? Here's looking at you. Here's looking at you, kid.
Oh, I can't remember. I forget what the final line is, but it is pretty, it's famous. But I always think of the one scene wherever there's the French police inspector and he's at the Rick's casino, the gambling place, and they want him to shut it down. And he's like, I don't want to. He's like, he goes there all the time. He's friends with Rick. And he's like, no, you have to. And he's like, he blows his whistle. He goes, I am closing this place down. I am shocked and astounded to find out there is gambling going on here. And they're like, here, you're winning, sir. And he goes, oh, thank you.
As classic as that is, I'm embarrassed to say I've never watched that all the way through.
Oh, it's a great movie.
It's hard for me to watch black and white movies. I mean, even when they were modern day ones, you know, Young Frankenstein was black and white.
Oh, it's great, man.
I don't know, but I hated to watch it.
What is that? Steve Martin one? Dead Men Wear Plaid?
Or something like that.
It was black and white, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I don't even know. Am I right? Was Young Frankenstein in black and white?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I was thinking that, but I didn't. After I said it, then I started thinking, was that right? I don't know. I have foggy memories. I've been around for so long. There's things that happened so long ago in my past. I don't know if they were real or not.
Your brain is AB normal.
That's right. But anyway, our fine members of Congress, they're not exempt from the laws that ban insider trading because they generally do not have a confidential relationship with the source of information they receive. However, they do meet the usual definition of an insider. House of Representatives rules may, however, consider congressional insider trading unethical. A 2004 study found that stock sales and purchases by senators outperformed the market by 12.3% a year.
That's what we would call in statistical review significant.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think there's a coincidence there. This guy that studies this points out several examples of insider trading by members of Congress, including action taken by Spencer Baucus following a private behind-the-doors meeting on the evening of September 8, 2008 with Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke. He informed members of Congress about the imminent financial crisis. Baucus then shorted stocks the next morning and cashed in his profits within a week. Also attending the same meeting were Senator Dick Durbin and John Boehner. The same day, trade effective the next day, Durbin sold mutual fund shares worth $42,696 and reinvested it all with Warren Buffett. Also the same day, trade effective the next day, Congressman Boehner cashed out of an equity mutual fund. In May 2007, a bill entitled Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge Act, or STOCK Act.
That's possibly the best acronym ever, by the way.
Was introduced that would hold congressional and federal employees liable for stock trades they made using information they gained through their jobs, and also regulates an analyst or political intelligence firms that research government activities. The 2012 STOCK Act was passed on April 4th, 2012. In 2014, prosecutors issued a subpoena to the House Ways and Means Committee and Brian Sutter, a staff director of its health care subcommittee, relative to a price move in stocks just prior to the passage of a law favorable to the companies involved. An email was sent out by a Washington-based policy research firm that predicted the change in the law for its Wall Street clients. That alert, in turn, was based in part on information provided to the firm by a former congressional health care aide turned lobbyist, according to emails reviewed by the Wall Street Journal.
There's your smoking gun.
Yep. But it's just endless. I mean, it's just another form of corporate greed.
It is. And they keep doing it and doing it. And that's how they end up getting caught, actually, is their greed is what does them in, usually.
And but, you know what really makes me mad?
What's that?
I'm not in a position to benefit from any of it. Now, if I was in on it, I wouldn't be so upset about it. But since I'm on the outside looking in, by God, I want my fair share. Now, if people pay me off, I'll quit talking about it.
You hear that, advertisers?
Advertisers, I want a direct cash. Straight cash, homie.
Straight cash. Well, that's going to do it for this episode and bring us to
Legal Briefs.
So Legal Briefs is the part of the show where we talk about different legal terms and kind of just a little review section. So I'm going to ask Tommy to give me a couple definitions. What is insider trading?
Insider trading is people that have the ability to have knowledge of things or events that may affect a stock's increase or decrease, and the general public wouldn't have it. And they take that knowledge and act on it.
Exactly. Now, that was the key word I was looking for, was the whole not available to the general public, because that's really what it is that's the crux of this. And that's why the whole stock law you just talked about, why that's important too, because the general public's not available. They're not available to that information.
All those John Does and Tom Smurls out there, we don't have a chance.
What year did insider trading become illegal?
I would say 1934.
I believe that is correct. That was when it was passed. And
They passed it in 33, and they have a Securities Act of 33. Then they updated it in 34. I think that maybe they didn't get all the language in there.
Yeah, 34 was actually the one that they use today, I think, became in 34.
Yeah, I think they had some flaws in 33.
What does the SEC stand for?
The Southeastern Commission. Securities and Exchange Commission.
That's right.
I do better with that than I did with the football term.
And what does CFTC stand for?
I can't remember all that. Tell me.
Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
Yeah, that's the one that talked about the trading places. Murphy law came from that.
It's similar to the SEC, but they deal with futures. So, which I didn't even know they existed until I started doing some research for this episode.
I didn't either. I never heard of that. I never heard of the Eddie Murphy law.
Now, this is a it's a personal opinion question, but who is your favorite insider trader who is also a homemaker turned con who moved to West Virginia at the behest of a federal judge?
Martha Stewart.
That's right.
I'm doing a Julia Child imitation of Martha Stewart.
Hey, if it works, it works.
I got one for you.
Oh, okay.
It's a softball, though.
Uh-oh.
I know you'll get it.
Uh-oh.
It surprised me, but I figure you'll remember this because it's pretty easy to remember. Who was the first commissioner of the SEC?
That would be Joe Kennedy something or another.
Senior. Yeah. Joseph P. Kennedy Senior.
Yeah, it's John Kennedy's father.
Correct.
Yep.
He was the guy.
Yeah, that I did not know that. It shocked me. So.
Yeah, well, I guess that's where the Kennedys first started in their political stuff, I guess.
Yeah. Got to start somewhere.
That's right.
Why not with the SEC?
And that's why not?
That's where
they're the most powerful conference in football.
They are. That's where a lot of greats have gotten their start.
That's right. That's where Joe Willie Namath came from.
Did he?
Yeah, he played for Alabama.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
I always think of him just with the Jets. I don't think of him in college.
Yeah. Well, he came out of Alabama and went to the Jets.
There you go.
Yeah, I think he was a Pennsylvania boy, if I remember right.
He was. I believe he was.
Came from Pennsylvania. They recruited him to Alabama, and he went back up near his home state.
Well, they always say that, the Ohio is the cradle of coaches, but I think that for a while there, Eastern PA was the cradle of quarterbacks because you had, Joe Namath, Joe Montana.
Did he come from up there? No, he played for Notre Dame.
He did, but I think he was from that area as well. So,
Well, you never know. You'd think with a name like Joe Montana, he'd be from Montana.
I mean,
why didn't they name him Joe Pennsylvania?
That's where Johnny Utah is from, Utah, right?
Sure.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well, then not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out, though, right?
Usually.
Good.
This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf. And I'm just a dude.
Thanks for listening.